could it really be? That stuff was sending skyward.
Well, we can turn it around, is what the song says. Maybe we can't. What if we actually don't have the answers? What if we don't have the solutions we need to, we can't stop climate change, but to slow it enough to, well, make nature notice and make all of us notice that things are finally going to start getting better instead of worse, as our weather, extreme weather shows us, you know, that's the direction we're heading, in the wrong direction. Well, that's a question that I'm sure Reverend Earl Cotin has some thoughts about. I got to know him a little bit a couple of weeks ago when I was at a climate change communications training seminar, and it was all about solutions and how to engage people in conversations about global warming, or climate disruption, as we're now told to call it. And someone raised his hand and said, well, what if there are not adequate solutions? And isn't it a bit misleading to think that, and tell people that we actually have the answers, when really we don't have the answers, at least not to the same scale as the problem? I am paraphrasing and maybe misquoting, but that's what I recall. So I had to meet this guy, went up and introduced myself to Reverend Earl Cotin, who joins me on the Green Front now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And then last night we were at another upbeat seminar on energy. I had a panel including the esteemed Richard Heinberg, who's written some 10 books on the future of energy and the end of oil, the end of growth. And you raised your hand again and said something similarly sobering. But I like people who tell it like it is, and I don't think we should, quote, kill the messenger or even attack the messenger. I don't know if you heard the first segment, but we just were speaking with a professor who's written a book on saying that everything we're doing right now is not nearly enough. You might agree with some of that anyway, but perhaps you did hear some of it.
I heard most of it, and I can understand why you wanted a minister for the second half of your show.
God help us.
Yeah, something along
Let's
that
laugh.
Line. Yes, and no, I normally preach not do stand-up comedy, but there are days when I wish I had talents at both. I do agree with your previous guest that if we're talking about something that is going to immediately or rapidly reverse the predicament we have gotten ourselves into, I don't see anything on the horizon. And I've only been doing this work for about 3 years, but early on, you know, one of my first questions is, why on earth are we acting so contrary to our own interest? I understand that lemmings do not, you know, walk off cliffs, but I do know that whales beach themselves, and it seemed like as a culture we were beaching ourselves, and I didn't understand why we were, you know, sort of in an ecocide or almost suicidal posture as we continue to increase the level of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere.
Well, I want to get into, I want to find out what your where your studies have taken you, but let me just back up a little bit and say that you are a consulting
sure.
minister for climate justice. That's not what you set out to do. As you mentioned, this is a relatively new line of work for you. You're not in your 20s. So what were you doing previously, and what led you to this point?
Well, I did my undergraduate work in psychology, and I worked in human resources and organizational development for about 30 years with the federal government before retiring and going to seminary. And in seminary and in my residencies afterwards, I decided that I was going to do psychiatric chaplaincy because I really enjoyed the work. Unfortunately, I made the mistake of going to a presentation by Dan Miller called A Really Inconvenient Truth, and Dan starts his presentation with a bell curve, and at the center of the bell curve is the word biblical, and at the far end of the bell curve is game over. And I, you know, naturally wanted to think Dan didn't know what he was talking about, but when unfortunately I did some research and found out he did, I changed the direction of my ministry because I felt it was more important for me to focus.
Wow. Does Dan know this? I know Dan from Al Gore's climate training, and know that he urges his listeners to first apologize to their children for what mess we're leaving behind.
And that's absolutely right. Yes, I do know Dan, and I've seen him on several occasions. And I do not have quite as an apocalyptic view as he does, but it is true that one of the first things I needed to do was to apologize for my children. And they were my first and still remain in some way my strongest motive for the work that I do. I come from generations of people who always wanted their children to be better off than they were, and certainly did not intend to create the situation that we're in today. But I had to wrestle with a lot of guilt and even despair when I really understood how bad the situation was, how I contributed to it, and how, in a sense, I felt like I had been sleepwalking through these changes while focused on other issues.
So you decided, rather than focus on helping individuals, you would turn your attention towards helping the culture, accept the climate reality we're facing?
Well, I think the first bit of work I do, and I do this both with groups and with individuals, is grief work. I think that before we can reasonably face the future and the changes that are already well documented in, you know, books such as Slow Violence and The Tropic of Chaos, we need to grieve. And we need to be accountable for our own culpability in this. No one has clean hands. Mm. But we're not all equally culpable. You know, most of us are not oil company executives, or we have not been paid to lie to the public and deceive it. And so while we all have some share of culpability and responsibility, and it's important for us to acknowledge that, we need to go beyond that to get in a position where we can actually make a difference and help out. Running through my mind this morning was the beginning of A Tale of Two Cities. You know, it was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
Hmm. What do you say to those who say that this is a very exciting time to be alive because we have so much at stake and so much is in our hands? And that can be kind of inspiring until you go out and just start listening to what people are talking about. And even where I live, as I often say, in pretty well-educated, higher-income San Francisco Bay Area, I don't hear people talking about this stuff. And so somewhere in between the Exxon executives and those of us ecomaniacs, you know, lies the public. And they're pretty complacent or too busy doing, you know, what all. How do we get this conversation into the mainstream so we have a chance of, you know, putting American ingenuity and innovation to work?
There are a lot of different ways, but one of the ways that I have, let me talk about two ways. One is, whatever passion you have, could be reproductive justice, it could be marriage equality, it could be end nuclear war, your work is going to be short-sighted if you're not paying attention to the changing environment.
Hmm.
And so the importance of connecting whatever your interest is, you know, whether it's the economy or healthcare or politics, to the environment in which it's occurring is critical if you're going to do good work. So I no longer try to convince people that this is the most important thing going, even though I absolutely believe it is. Rather, I say, well, you know, what's the connection? So I was talking to an immigration activist the other day, and we had a Reese's Pieces moment. You know, she got chocolate on my peanut butter, and I got peanut butter on her chocolate. I realized that my work in climate activism and considering, you know, human migration around climate change was not going to be grounded unless I understood the immigration issues we were already dealing with and the environmental racism that's already here in these United States. Similarly, she appreciated that indeed their work was going to be short-sighted and some of their victories might be pyrrhic if they weren't looking at the long-term trends where the climate change, I'm talking about storms and floods and crop failures and other things like that, is going to drive human migration on a level that we've never seen before. So it's sort of like, if we think we have problems now, it's going to get a lot worse, and therefore we need to prepare. So it was actually a moment of real connection and a sense of an opportunity to make a difference. And I have since found other immigration activists who really get it. You know, they left their countries because the corporations came in, took over the land, covered it with pesticides, and made the place unlivable. They get to El Norte and they end up in West Phoenix or West Oakland or East Coachella, and they find environmental racism. They find the same sort of damage. So part of what my work is helping to introduce people who, for the most part, have been exempted from some of the worst by the bubbles of privilege in which they live, to the suffering that is already occurring in communities that don't have that kind of protection.
Mm. Can you talk a little bit about, this is a bit of a switch, but we only have about another 10 minutes, and I want to make sure we get to this, because I asked some of my friends who were kind of depressed about the situation environmentally to listen in, because I think you have a message for us, and that is that while painful, dealing with our eco-reality is really a sign of positive mental health, at least as a first step. Expand on that, if I've interpreted what you said correctly.
Yes. Several years ago, there was a book written called Eco-Psychology. A friend of mine who's a social worker was one of the contributed one of the articles. And more recently, there's a new book out called Ecotherapy. And one of the points it makes is, you know, something that I've often said, it's a little bit of a joke, but it's, you know, it's along the lines of the joke, even paranoids have real enemies. Well, my joke is that if you're not depressed, you're not paying attention. That a certain degree of, you know, concern and even depression is an appropriate response to the situation we're in, and the failure of our culture to respond to it in a life-affirming manner. However, once you've worked through some of the grief, there is tremendous joy on the other side, because young adults and people of color and people from disadvantaged communities are so much more knowledgeable than boomers like myself. And they're reaching out to one another. They don't have some of the obstacles that my generation has. And, you know, Carl Anthony said the other day, and it really touched my heart, because it was sort of what I'd been thinking but hadn't formed into words yet, that this is our best opportunity for racial harmony since the mid-60s. This is really an opportunity for us to work together and to be engaged. So depression and isolation is not a good thing. Being depressed about what's going on is quite understandable. Going out and being in community can make a difference. And I would recommend to people Rebecca Solnit's A Paradise Built in Hell, about how crisis and challenge is often what brings people out and builds community. And I have just seen some amazingly beautiful things happening, and I have learned so much from young adults and others who really, you know, are so much more knowledgeable than I am. I'm never going to pretend to be an engineer or a scientist, and therefore I've really had to turn to others, but, you know, also young environmental activists, environmental attorneys, there are all sorts of people out there who just have had a much better education about these matters than I did.
What about those working on the technological solutions? Do you feel that that is necessary but not enough, or not really even worth putting a lot of resources into, as my previous guest indicated, unless it's truly, you know, green, clean technologies that maybe haven't even been invented, let alone, you know, conceived yet? Or, you know, what role solutions, and what's appropriate in your view?
And there's an old Islamic statement, trust in Allah, but tie up your camel. I'm not of the ilk to expect a miracle. I am of the ilk that learns from the insurance industry or learns from my experience in healthcare. You know, if someone says to you, you have cancer, and then you ask what to do, and they say, well, you know, you need to change your diet, and you need to exercise more, and we got to put you on this medication for a while, you're not going to do just one of those things. You're going to do as many things as possible. If some sort of technological miracle comes to bear, that would be just wonderful. But my denomination is littered with scientists and engineers, and the best advice that I've received so far is that we really don't have any, you know, Pasteur's magic bullet, you know, on the horizon right now. And this is really much more a matter of political will and creating the people power to offset the financial power that is dragging us all down.
And there is such a need for community and uniting over some shared cause, and we have it right here in front of us. How can we catalyze that? Because people are feeling more isolated and just discouraged and therefore withdrawn than ever, generalizing, but I'm finding that in my travels, and apparently you are too.
Well, you know, I will tell you what
resigned.
I've been doing.
Resigned. I think resigned is the word I'm looking for, resigned. And then we're going to talk about another R word, resilience, before we have to wrap up.
In my work with Unitarian Universalist congregations, but also with community groups and activists, et cetera, I always tell people when they're trying to get started, start with your friends. You know, hopefully you have some, and you can talk to them, and you'll be surprised. I mean, I was surprised when I found out one of my friends had written for this first book on eco-psychology, and another friend is an editor at Science Magazine, and another friend, you know, it turns out to have worked in clean energy for 30 years, you know, so start out with the people you trust and you're close to, and ask them what they know and what they're doing, and can they recommend, you know, Dan Miller led me to read Bill McKibben. Bill McKibben led me to 350.org. It's a matter of sort of finding a trail. As someone who spent a lot of his career in government, government is a lot better organized than the nonprofit sector. And so it does take some looking around to figure out which organizations you want to affiliate with. But I can tell you, most of them will welcome you with open arms. And there'll be an opportunity to really become engaged and have a sense of doing the right thing in difficult times.
We just have a couple minutes left. So you talk about resilience. We're going to need that, aren't we?
Yeah, in listening yesterday at the program, I sort of made myself a little list of R's. Resilience, renewal, resistance, redistribution, and risk. I think, you know, I've stopped thinking that we have the capacity right now to stop the momentum of environmental devastation that's already underway. I'm hoping we can slow it down, and that's what I'm working to do, but I don't think we can stop it. And I think things are going to get worse before they get better. This means we need to build resilience. We need to build skills. We need to have a way to renew ourselves, to find joy and community and faith in the midst of these storms. We have to actively resist. There's going to be more and more direct action out there. My hope is that it will be nonviolent, but I'm not confident of that.
And maybe the first opportunity for that will be, and maybe Keystone will be the first opportunity for that.
Right. In fact, there's a wonderful piece on the internet right now about the arrest of Ben Franklin and the way he was tortured by the police. And this is Ben Franklin, who was a young adult Unitarian Universalist. There's also a new film out, Bitter 70, about Tim DeChristopher, who went to prison for the illegal oil, and that's going to be shown in San Francisco and in Berkeley, in San Francisco on Thursday and in Berkeley next Tuesday.
Reverend Cotien, I thank you. We're going to have you back on the show because we are out of time, and I just barely scratched the surface of tapping into your wisdom and your wealth of knowledge and your practical approach. I really appreciate all that. And Reverend Cotien,
thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
With the Unitarian Universalist Legislative Ministry of California. That's a long title. He's a consulting minister for climate justice and my new friend. That does it for this edition of The Green Front. Check out the show, the archives at PRN.fm or thegreenfront.com. Till next time, have a great green week.